on an informational meeting with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife regarding the cougar management plan. So if we could have Roy.
Chair, members of the committee, appreciate the opportunity to come forward to committee today and give some background and an overview of our latest revisions to our cougar management, statewide cougar management plan. We have, I don't want to be extra long today, Mr. Chair. It is a complex subject. We have some good information in the testimony that we're passing out. We're also presenting for each of the members a copy of the cougar management plan itself, to look through why we give testimony, and for you, it's not over $10.
You should anyway. Be paying us to read this stuff, Roy. I'm sorry.
But it is a state plan, so I think it's probably covered. But anyway, let me kind of move through his testimony. Both Ron and I are going to talk. I'm going to take the first half, the introduction background. Ron's going to move more into the plan specifics and how we're implementing the plan as of 2007, where we've just begun implementation. By way of introduction, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is charged to, and excuse me, Mr. Chair, for the record, my name again, Roy Elliker, Deputy Director for Fish and Wildlife Programs, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is charged through wildlife policy, ORS 496.012, to manage all fish and wildlife in the state of Oregon. We have seven co-equal goals. We've listed those out for you, but in particular, maintaining optimum populations of fish and wildlife, permitting the utilization of wildlife, regulating populations in a manner compatible with primary uses of land and waters, and making decisions that benefit wildlife and allow for the best social, economic, and recreational utilization by all user groups are some of the highlights of those seven goals. The following briefing is designed to give a brief overview of cougar management in Oregon. Oregonians have long viewed cougars with a mixture of dislike, fear, and awe, and they are certainly been a part of native wildlife in Oregon, I guess, since time immemorial, as some tribes might say. Up until 1967, cougars were classified as predators in Oregon. This meant there was indiscriminate killing of cougars with no regards to seasons, bag limits, or methods of take. Frankly, if anyone saw a cougar out there prior to 1967, they could shoot it, and they'd probably be, all their neighbors would probably give them a reward for it. In the 1960s, concerned hunters, particularly led by numbers of hound hunters, worked hard to convince the department and then the Oregon legislature to redefine cougars from a predator status to a game mammal status. And in other hearings and discussions like this, Mr. Chair, Roger Martin, if he was here in the room, will admit that he was one of the ones that voted in 1967 to make cougars a game mammal. They were successful in their lobbying efforts, and it led to a change in the law in 1967, making them game mammals. And so that gave them, it closed the door, frankly, an unregulated harvest. During the same time frame, we conducted an analysis of known information on cougars in the state and estimated that by 1960, only about 200 cougars were presently in the state. And frankly, if it's the department's impression from the data at the time that without the changes pushed in 67, by 1970, there probably would have been no cougars in the state of Oregon. Since 1970, the department has very actively managed cougar populations. We first developed our first management plan in 1987 and then updated it in 1993, and lastly in 2006, which we're going to talk more specifically about today and which you have a copy of in front of you right now. Each plan was designed to provide direction for managing cougar populations by addressing damage by individual cougars and chronic cougar damage in defined areas. Regulated hunting, primarily using trained dogs, was used as the primary tool to control populations and address damage. This is another example of what some people refer to as the North American model for wildlife management, and one of the most successful wildlife models in the world. And primarily it's been the hunting public that has driven this change, these changes since the early 1900s. The department estimates the cougar population has grown from a low of 200 in 1960 to approximately 2,300 in 1987, and now we feel it's about 5,400 cougars. These numbers are based on a predictive population model that is a scientifically peer-reviewed model published in Northwest Science in 2002. Models, of course, have their limitations since they are based on assumptions like other biological models, but we've listed out in the rest of that paragraph some of the factors that are taken into account by our modeling system, including breeding, pregnancy rates, birth rates, mortality rates, other issues like that. And we can always provide more information on the technical aspects of the biological model, but it is a peer-reviewed model, and we're very proud of that. The department has over 20 years of actual data collected on cougars that have been harvested by hunters and from damage complaints. And, in fact, we've had four different research projects located in both northeast and southwestern Oregon specifically learn on cougars. This data has also been compared to research results published in other states and universities, and we work closely with the other western states through the Western Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies on cougar issues, both within the state and as general in the western United States. So, again, the model gets us to about 5,400. Moving on to bottom of page two, as cougar populations have increased and human population and growth has expanded, we've seen more and more cougar-human conflicts. These conflicts can be varied, but we basically group what we call conflicts in three general categories. These include conflicts regarding human safety, regarding pets, and regarding livestock. And I'm going to let, when we get to plan implementation, there will probably be some questions about how we measure complaints and how we use that within the plan, and Ron can address that at that time. Anyway, but as far as the human safety issues,
those are the three. We don't talk about depredation of other wildlife with respect to looking at the plan.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. For the purposes of damage complaints, we do not look at impacts to big game populations, just dealing specifically with tracking impacts that are related to humans. This is what we're dealing with here. And the new plan does get into the other factors.
So, generally, we've had a lot of questions as we implemented this plan about what is a complaint and how is that addressed by the department. And the fact that someone might see a cougar or what they may think is a cougar and call in to the department does not necessarily mean that we treat that as a complaint. There are a number of times during the year, if you talk to our field folks, that folks believe they see a cougar, turns out to be something else. Especially when you see something at long distance, you're not quite sure. But really, generally, a lot of people that see cougars end up calling us to just report them, or if they thought they saw a cougar. And so we have a lot of what we call sightings. However, once there's a sighting with accompanied by some other type of behavior, like the cat seen repeatedly in the same area, maybe following people or seen in and around buildings or livestock, at that point we escalate from a sightings to perhaps a human safety complaint or a livestock complaint. In general, we've documented an increase in these complaints since the late 1980s. Once there is a complaint, somebody calls in to complain to the department, we try and resolve these ways in the simplest and easiest ways possible for all the parties. A lot of times, just personal call and say they saw a cougar on their property, wants to talk to our district biologist. We'll talk through what they saw and how the cat acted. A lot of times folks just want to know that we're aware that they saw a cat that was on their property. However, didn't see it really doing anything other than they saw it. And for most people, that's a big deal, believe you me, to see a cougar, since even now. So a lot of times just by talking to the person over the phone, we can kind of resolve the sighting or complaint. In other places, particularly where it's attacked, or killed livestock, under ORS 498.012, which is called the Animal Damage Statute, the landowner can have that cougar removed or kill that cougar himself or herself. There are times when some landowners go ahead, once they know that if they see that cougar and it is attacking the livestock, will just shoot it themselves or to have someone come and trap it and remove themselves. Many other times they ask the department come and work with, and we work with them and wildlife services to try and catch the cat and remove it. And more specific questions, again, we're going to get those under the plan. We also manage, and since the 1990s, non-hunting mortality has steadily increased throughout the state. As mentioned previously, we also allow hunting of cougars. Now, historically, this was done in a controlled hunt situation. That means if you wanted to hunt cougars, say, in the fall of 2007, before Measure 18, frankly, you would have applied under our lottery system and applied to get a permit to kill a cougar in a particular area, like we do with big game, like elk and deer, mountain goats, and those kind of things. From the early 70s through the early 90s, control hunts were conducted in areas that had a high number of damage or human safety complaints. So generally, by the 90s, before Measure 18, less than about half the state was open to cougar hunting, with only slightly less than about 600 tags per year allowed. And the seasons were about 2 to 4 months long, depending on how many cougars we thought would be we want to remove from that area. Again, all this management changed in 1994 to pass Measure 18. I think everybody here in the room probably and in front of me realized Measure 18, what it did essentially stopped the use of dogs to hunt cougars in the state of Oregon. However, there are allowances for employees or agents of county, state, or federal agencies to use dogs in official capacity. Since Measure 18, department, and frankly, in some ways, has struggled to effectively manage cougar populations. At this point, to encourage cougar hunting, we have a statewide 10-month-long general season. In some areas of the state, it's actually 12 months long. And with a hunter's ability to kill two cougars, and also the tag price got lowered from $50 to $10. Today, about 35,000 hunters have cougar tags and have harvested cats around the state. However, while some of the public pointed out that more cougars are being killed today than before dogs were used, I guess we want to make sure that we put this in perspective. At the peak of hound hunting, before Measure 18, we have about less than 600 tag holders harvested about 200 cougars a year, while today about 35,000 hunters harvest a little over 250 cougars in 2004. So Ron will talk a little bit more about what that means in terms of how we have designed this newest revision of the cougar plan and taking into account that one of our most effective tools to manage cougars in the state, which was hound hunting by sportsmen, has been removed from our toolbox, so to speak, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
If I have a question, should I hold till the end of the presentation?
Which would you rather?
No, please, go right ahead. Thank you, Representative Clinton.
I'll try to just ask one here. On this number, 35,000 hunters killed up to 265 cougars in 2004. Does that include people that we had to pay to go do it as, to go take a damaged animal on behalf of the state, or is that really just truly what a hunter got while, out doing something else and got lucky?
Chair Roble and Representative Clem, that only includes cougars that were killed by hunters. There is an additional number of cats that are killed above and beyond that through wildlife services or through the department or through the landowner's agents. And in the graph in Figure 2, it kind of gives you a perspective of the total harvest, which for 2005 was close to 500 cougars for the whole state in relation to the total estimated population.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, Mr. Chair, I'll get into some of the specifics relative to the...
I don't think you announced who you were for the record.
Okay. Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. In spring of 2006, our commission adopted the 2006 revision of the Cougar Management Plan. And in this plan, we made some major changes that had not been present in previous plans. We divided the state up into six general management zones where we would evaluate and measure the population within each of those zones, and then we would look at harvest levels both by hunters and cats taken on damage and calculate that into our overall population estimates and what we were doing with the population and the direction it was headed. Key to the adoption of the management plan were five main objectives that set the direction that we would manage cougars over the course of the next 5 to 10 years. Objective one was designed to ensure that we maintain a cougar population of at least 3,000 cougars within the state. We wanted to make sure that no matter what happened, we never went back to where we were in the 60s, where we had approximately 200 cougars. If for whatever reason, the cougar population were to drop to 3,000 animals or less, we would immediately suspend all hunting seasons. We would immediately suspend all of the special actions that we can take as an agency, and only cougars that are caught in specific damage situations or human safety situations would be allowed to be taken as authorized under statute. Objective 2 was specifically designed to identify and clarify what are the triggers, if you will, that allow us to take any kind of administrative action. And what we looked at was, at the 1994 level, when we had 3,000 cougars, what were the level of non-hunting mortality or animals that were killed on damage complaints in each of the zones. In some of the zones, there were no cougars killed as a result of damage. We felt that having a trigger that would allow us to take additional actions of zero was probably inappropriate. So based on that, looking at what the population had grown through the year 2000, we adjusted the triggers for some of those zones to the 2000 level so that we had what we felt was a more realistic number. Again, we have specific safeguards in place associated with this objective that would ensure that we would not over-harvest specifically the female component of the population and drive it down to unacceptable levels. Objectives 3 through 5 are specific actions that the Commission has authorized the Department to take. In Objective 3, it is designed specifically to manage, proactively manage, human safety and pet conflicts across the state and within each of the management zones. If we meet the criteria outlined in Objectives 1 and 2, in other words, we have at least 3,000 cougars within the state and we meet the zone criteria for Objective 1, and we also meet the trigger criteria for non-hunting mortality in Objective 2, we can establish what we call a target area that allows us to go in and administratively remove cougars ourselves from that specific target area. Again, we've built in safeguards to ensure that we do not over-harvest the female component within in that target area, and also looking at the overall zone objectives and making sure that we comply with that. Likewise, Objective 4 was designed to address the same thing for livestock damage and has the same criteria and the same safeguards in place. Objective 5 gets to the question that you asked earlier, Representative Roblin, on what would we do in those areas where we're aware that cougars are having an impact on big game populations. We specifically know through our research in Northeast Oregon that cougars are having a dramatic impact on elk calf survivability and are limiting recruitment and allowing the population to decline. We have looked very specifically at animal pregnancy rates, we've looked at health and nutrition, and we can find nothing that would indicate that any of those are a factor in the decline of those populations. The research has so far shown that cougars are the primary reason the population is declining. Likewise, in some of our bighorn sheep population releases where we're trying to reestablish populations, we have specific data that shows cougars have caused those populations to decline to the point, in some cases, where we no longer allow hunting. And that is a big disappointment to us in that we have spent and used $100 and hunter contributions to reestablish those populations and bring them back from extinction, because sheep, bighorn sheep, were extinct in this state by the 1940s. Each of the management objectives and actions that will be implemented by the department will be monitored at three levels, at the statewide level, at the zone level, and by the target area.
If you have a BlackBerry or a cell phone, even if it's in a silent mode, if it's on, it causes that feedback, the new equipment here. So if you have a cell phone, BlackBerry, please just turn it to the off position. Thanks.
During the first year of the plan implementation, the department went through a series of criteria, and we identified three target areas for administrative removal of cougars to reduce conflicts. Figure 3, which is page 7 in your packet, illustrates the six management zones as well as three target areas. As you can see, there is one in far eastern Oregon outside of Ontario in the Beulah unit that was designed to address livestock damage, one in the Heppner unit just outside of Heppner to address big game concerns, and then one in southwestern Oregon outside of Medford and Grants Pass to address human safety pet concerns. Page 8 details some of the specifics for each one of these target areas. All of them are around 1,000 square miles, and as I already stated, each has different objectives and specific purposes. Trapping is the primary method that we'll try and use to reduce the cougar population in the, the East Beulah unit. We have a target of 12 cougars to catch, and as of this point in time, we have not caught any.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
How long have we sort of allotted for this conversation?
About half an hour, a little longer.
Okay, so may I ask a question?
Sure.
I hunt the Beulah unit for deer. I've never seen a cougar. So I'm not surprised you haven't, had any yet found. I guess my question is on these 264 cougars, how many of these people are actually out looking even? I mean, you'd run around on foot trying to catch a cougar. I don't understand how they even got one, to be honest.
Chair Roble and Representative Clem, in the early days after the passage of Measure 18, most of the cougars that were harvested were what we would call incidental to other activities. They were deer hunting, they were elk hunting, maybe they were bird hunting, and they'd see a cougar and take it. In recent times, we actually have a segment of our hunters that have figured out that they can, in the wintertime, after there's snow on the ground, go out, locate cougar tracks, and start tracking the cougar. And if they can get close enough to set up and actually use predator calls to call the cougar into them. We have some hunters that are consistently taking cougars every year using this method. So while we still have a large number of cats that are killed as incidental to other activities, we're seeing more and more people that are going out specifically in the wintertime to look for cats and are being successful in killing them.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, I have never actually tried to hunt cougars. I'm not a cougar hunter. I have no conflict of interest here. I just am saying while hunting for my deer that I have a hard time getting also. FYI, I have not run across a cougar, sir.
I understand.
Thank you.
In the Heppner management or target area, similar to the others, we are also looking at using trapping, but we also have the ability there to use dogs. We've targeted 30 cougars for removal, and up to this point in time, we've removed 8.
Mr. Chair, sorry, if I might.
Yes.
Now, on using these dogs, we have to pay the people to go use these dogs because they can't be agents of the state because we don't allow volunteer. It's not defined correctly. Well, it's not defined yet in the statute that a volunteer with the dog could really play that role for, so we're having to pay.
That's correct, Chair Roland and Representative Clem, and I'm going to get into that in just a second and what the costs are to us as an agency.
And I have a bill, Mr. Chair, that would remedy that part, just so we're all knowing that may be coming from me. Thank you.
And as stated, in the Jackson County area, we have a target number of 24 cougars to remove. We're planning on using traps, and if we can find qualified individuals, use dogs. And to this point in time, we have not removed any cats. At the bottom of page 8, you'll see that our estimated cost for administrative removal of cougars in the three target areas for this fiscal year is roughly almost $122,000. And for the second year, which will be fiscal year 08 for us, the cost is estimated at $144,000. We've broken that out in Table 1 on page 9 as to the individual cost for each one of the target areas. You can see that for the Heppner area that the cost is considerably higher than it is for the others, and that's primarily because we're looking to use department personnel to trap cougars during the summer months prior to us hiring anybody to actually go out using dogs or traps during the winter months.
Mr. Chair, can I ask
yes.
a quick question? Mr. Hanley, can you tell me what kind of traps you use?
Chair Roble and Representative Smith, I can't remember the exact name of them, but we have worked with Wildlife Services, who are experts at trapping animals, and we've also worked through the National trapping organizations through the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies on securing the right kinds of traps. The exact name escapes me right now, but it's a non-tooth trap that is very effective at catching cougars as a leg hold trap, and in certain circumstances, we also utilize snares.
Thank you.
The intent in all of this is that as we move through, we will employ what we call adaptive management in how we are addressing implementation of the cougar management areas. And adaptive management to us is, for example, at the end of the first year, and recognizing this is just a trial year for us and really getting our feet wet on implementation, that you would look and say, okay, utilizing the methods that we used, were we effective, were we not effective? Were we effective at certain times of the year versus other times of the year? Are there adjustments that we should make? Are we doing certain things that might be having unintended consequences? Have we got to the point where we have harvested the number of females that causes us to shut down the target area? So in our mind, adaptive means that we can evaluate the data as we move along, and annually we'll be reporting back to our commission every June on what we've done with target area implementation as part of our big game tag setting process, and making adjustments to any target area implementation as we go. At this point in time, it's too early really to evaluate the results of the initial target areas. We're still in the process of implementation. I would say, though, that we have been successful in killing cougars when we've had snow on the ground and using dogs. We've been unsuccessful in killing cougars with the use of traps or snares. There is a high cost associated with this, and like I said, we're still evaluating the effectiveness. So with that, Chair Roblin, concludes our testimony. We'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you, gentlemen. And I was saying, I think this is about the fifth time I've heard the cougar presentation, but I learn something new every time. So, and I have heard a cougar. Actually, it was in Representative Smith's district, and
I have a lot of them.
I was hiking, and I have never run down a trail so fast in my life. But anyway, question I have is, I've perused this report a couple of times, and I don't recall seeing or hearing anything about what we do to try to manage the urban-rural interface as our cities continue to grow and we also encroach on what could be formerly cougar habitat areas. You know, what type of interaction do you have with local planners or planning agencies to look at managing areas of growth that do not necessarily encroach on known habitat? And I realize that cougars are very mobile, so they're not hanging out in one specific area. But, I mean, we see this not just with cougars, but lots of other species. And, you know, many other states, the same problems in Florida. We see it with alligator populations. And basically, we move into their territory, and then we basically, you know, get rid of them because they're in the way of our population growth. So I'm just curious what the philosophy of the department is on this particular issue.
Chair Roblin, Representative Dingfelder, first off, if you hear or see a cougar, don't run from it.
Wait, I'm still here.
Catch mechanism, and that's not good.
It was on the other side of the ridge, so I went down that way.
We do work with local county commissions and their planning departments to address all sorts of wildlife conflict. As you're aware, we really don't have a lot of influence on where development can occur. Cougars don't respect development. We have cougars in very, very urban settings in Portland, in Beaverton, in downtown Springfield, in Medford. We had them all the time in Klamath Falls when I was down there. We've had them in downtown Lakeview. We can't keep them out. And we certainly do not look at every cougar that shows up in that interface zone and is interacting with people as a bad cougar, and are not looking to remove all cougars simply because somebody sees them. If there's a history of problems, there's a history of aggressiveness, there's a history of losses, at that point in time, we would look to take some kind of action and working closely with the counties to do something like that. But as far as being able to address cougar-friendly zones within the rural-urban interface. The cougars define where they want to go, and they're not going to restrict themselves to any one particular area.
Thank you. I'll know not to run next time I see a cougar. Get my camera out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first, I guess I'd want to thank you for, you know, trying to deal with a situation that is kind of like Measure 37 we'll be dealing with later tonight. The voters inject themselves eventually sometimes in a process when they want to send a message. You know, I grew up hunting. I know a lot of people who hunt cougars. I never did it. I saw the TV commercials back at that time. You know, I think there are sometimes some things in the hunting community that people who, we have different ethics amongst ourselves. And there were things I didn't find particularly, you know, pleasant either that went on. Were there ever attempts or approaches to sort of regulate with a hunter using a dog, you know, what may amount to personal ethics in hunting? Did we ever try that? Or have there been things to talk about, you know, if you tree a cougar and for fun you send it on? You know, I don't know how much that happens, but those were the commercials that were implied. I know we're delving back into old debates here, but, you know, did we try to regulate the behavior at all before the ballot measure in previous years?
Chair Roblin, Representative Klim, in our discussions with houndsmen over the years, I think that you would find that they are no different than anybody else. There is a small fraction of their ranks that misbehaved. The bulk of them were not lawbreakers. They were law-abiding. When you look at the individuals that were harvesting cats or were working their dogs, they took more pictures than they ever harvested cougars. And, you know, with a very limited season, tag hunting or tag opportunities, people didn't draw tags very often. So they did. They would work their dogs. They liked working their dogs. And there was some illegal activity, just like there is with deer hunting or elk hunting. But really, it was a small segment of the hunting population. And we didn't do anything specifically to address ethics or anything like that, as you've mentioned, at that point in time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. A few questions. First, one from me, and then I have some. Mr. Kafori had asked me to ask a few questions, and we've talked to you about that beforehand. I'll get those on the record. But the first one that I wanted to ask was, since Measure 18, I know that since we've had the Cougar Plan, we have targets for different regions as to how many cougars that we would take in a given year. Have we ever met any of those targets?
Chair Roblin, we've met the harvest quotas under the old plan in two zones, three different times. And that is all.
And there are how many zones?
There are six.
And how many years?
I first set up the cougar management zones in 1995.
Okay.
So in the last 11 years, the harvest quota target had only been met three times.
Okay.
For each of the six zones.
So I think you already answered one of the questions, and it was, has adaptive management been used? And if so, how? And I think you mentioned that earlier. So.
Was there anything else you wanted me to add to that?
Not on that one, unless I think we're okay on that. Two, has any work been done to further refine the population model?
Chair Roblin, we are continually looking to update our population model, both from our own research that we're conducting as well as from research that's being conducted in other states. We do an annual review of the model. We look at the literature, and we have our primary researchers provide us with input. So we haven't conducted that from the conclusion of 2006 yet, but we do look at that at a regular basis and look to improve it.
Okay. Number three, what is the status of control efforts in areas that exceed the thresholds?
As I mentioned in my testimony, we have the three target areas, and we have had we've caught zero cougars in two of the three areas, and we have caught and harvested eight in one.
Okay.
So out of the 60 some odd that we had targeted for removal, we've only removed eight.
Is research being pursued to examine the response of cougar population to wolves?
At this point in time, we have no documented evidence of wolves in Oregon, and we have not explored that research at all. There are other states that have done some preliminary work, but I don't think there's anything that's been published yet.
And I do believe this is a good time to do pre-work. Just, yeah, that's my own personal one. I'll get into that one later.
Look, Chair Roblin, we are, in effect, doing pre-work in Northeast Oregon in the Sled Springs unit, where we do have cats that are collared, and we do have a baseline that we can rely on in the future.
Okay, that's good. And six, would ODF&W please respond in writing to the Oregon Chapter of Wildlife Society in regard to how our comments on the plan are being or not being used?
Yes.
Good. Thank you very much. I really do appreciate that. Any other questions?
One simple question. In the Jackson County target area, you harvested no cougars. Is that because you haven't actively started that piece of it, or you just have failed in those efforts?
Chair Roble and Representative Maurer, we have started. We've been on the ground trapping now for a little over a month, month and a half, and we have just been unsuccessful in catching any cats.
So at some point you will go to dogs if you are unsuccessful in trapping?
Chair Roble and Representative Maurer, we would look at using dogs. We have to be careful of the area that we would use dogs in. If you are in a spot where there is scattered small ownerships, we do not have permission to trespass, and we would have to have permission from those landowners to go on their property. So in some areas, it can be problematic to use dogs. The second problem that we've run into is that we're having a hard time finding people that still have dogs in the state that are trained enough that can be successful in running cats.
So that, if I...
Please, yes.
Representative Dingfeld, sorry, okay. Representative Dingfeld or stepped out, but that's an issue with the rural-urban interface, is when you have chopped up pieces of property, then your most successful tactic is taken out of your, as you said, your toolbox. Is that
Chair Roblin, Representative Maurer, that's correct. In the old days, prior to Measure 18, what we tried to do was to create holes in the population outside of those rural-urban interfaces so that cougars, in effect, filled the blank spots before they got down to the population zone. Any reverses of that would take a period of time to thin the cougars out within those conflict areas.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Klum.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That last point I just wanted to hit on before I go putting a new bill in play here. Is it possible to use a volunteer pool based on the availability of trained dogs? And in your judgment, is it possible to build some parameters around so it's the people that we deem ethical, essentially? I mean, I want people to do the right thing in this, but my constituents don't want to pay someone to have to do this when someone will do it for free as long as there's parameters around it, that you know they're not abusive, that they're trained. Can we do this if we get the law changed?
Chair Roblin, Representative Klim, we did in fact do this up until 1999 when the Department of Justice in our request looked at the definition of agent and whether we had the authority to employ agents and told us that no, we did not. Up until then, we did use volunteers in the manner you're suggesting.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Did you find any reports of abuse or mistreatment of the program at all?
Chair Roblin, Representative Klim, no, we didn't, because we were very careful in our screening of those individuals prior to that, and individuals that we felt might not fit well with the circumstances, we did not use.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I'll just say one last comment. I really appreciate your testimony, and I appreciate being here and willing to answer any of the questions. And I think that's what this is about, is to get that information out to people. My son-in-law had a wonderful experience in California when he was jogging, a little bit like Representative Dingfelder. Except in his case, he had been being stalked by a cougar as he was running, and the other runner going the other direction ran into the cougar, and the cougar just took off like any cat does. And the other runner ran around and says, "Did you know you had a cougar?" And he had no idea. I mean, cougars track us better than we track them. So it is interesting deal, and we saw that in the paper last week, the incident in California with the husband and wife and the cougar. So I really appreciate what you're doing and the fact that you are trying to stay on top of this issue with regard to human safety, pet safety, and livestock. So any other final things? Thank you very much.
Chair, I appreciate the opportunity very much to come here today. Thank you.
So we'll close our informational hearing.
Yes.
I think it's the speakers.
Oh, at each other.
Oh,
yeah. That could be it. Thanks. That's it. Very good. Thank you.
Isn't that cute?
Okay. We will be opening a hearing on House Bill 2288. And while we're doing that, we will have, to begin with, Aaron Kelly, is it Seal?
Seal.
Come up first. And in the meantime, we'll have our administrator read a short synopsis of the bill.
House Bill 2288 would create the Oregon Food Policy Council. The bill directs the council to review state and local food system issues for the purpose of recommending improvements to the linkage between food producers, consumers, and policymakers. The bill authorizes the council to develop and suggest strategies to improve food systems and create economic and health benefits, and it directs the Housing and Community Services Department to provide staff support for the council. The members should have in front of them four pieces of written testimony that were submitted via email, and there is no revenue impact. There may be a fiscal impact, but we have not received a statement, and there is no subsequent referral on the bill.
Okay. And so make sure that you introduce yourself as you get ready to speak, and we'll let our first panel, and this is probably Aaron, Rick, and Dalton Hobbs. Is that correct? Okay.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Aaron Kelly Seal, and I am the governor's advisor on human service issues. And in this role, I've had the privilege for the last 4 years of working with the governor to address the issue of hunger in our state. And that's really what House Bill 2288 is about. When the governor took office 3 years ago, I think probably everybody understands that that Oregon led the nation in hunger and unemployment. And under his leadership, Oregon has made some significant progress reducing hunger. Last year, in fact, Oregon was the only state in the country to reduce the number of people struggling to feed themselves and their families. There are two primary strategies that the governor has focused on in his fight against hunger. One is promoting awareness of the hunger problem and its root causes, and the second is to inspire citizens and communities throughout the state to take action to help end hunger in Oregon. If he could have been here today, the governor would have told you himself that our collective success so far is really only because thousands of Oregonians, rural and urban, young and old, businesses, individuals, Democrats and Republicans have joined together in this cause. The opportunity to pull people together who don't normally sit down at the same table with each other to make a difference in the fight against hunger is really what House Bill 2288 is about. The history of the statewide food policy council concept, I just want to kind of give you a quick glimpse of, if I may. In 2004, as part of the governor's annual hunger summit, the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force released what it called an Act to End Hunger. It was basically a 5-year strategic plan that included action steps and critical partners that it was recommending the state consider taking on as it worked on this issue. One of the goals identified in the report is that all Oregon residents would be food secure. And that means simply that all Oregonians can feed themselves and don't have to rely on emergency food sources for their families. Recognizing that Oregon's food system is a critical component of food security, the Act to End Hunger recommended that Oregon establish a statewide food policy council to create a venue for discussion among diverse players involved in the food system, farmers, producers, retailers, anti-hunger advocates, institutional food buyers, and household consumers. After listening to lots of hungry Oregonians, hunger advocates, farmers, and food and farming organizations, the governor really heard two things over and over. The first was that all of them had an interest in engaging with us in the fight against hunger. And the second was that when it came to Oregon's local and regional food systems, these groups weren't necessarily talking to each other about that interest. As a result, in the fall of 2004, as part of his annual Harvest Week, the governor announced his interest in the creation of a statewide food policy council. And since that time, our office has been involved in conversation with a small group of folks trying to just really create a vision for what the focus of that council could be. That small group discussion included anti-hunger advocates. It included the Department of Agriculture, representatives from the farming community, as well as several others who have an interest in this area, like the Oregon State University Extension Service. Last year, I was able to present an overview of this general concept to the State Board of Agriculture and get their feedback, and we've also had feedback regularly from the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force and the folks that are on that group. As I said earlier, the ultimate goal of the Food Policy Council is really to strengthen Oregon's food system and involve a diverse group of perspectives in discussion about how to do that, without predetermining any particular outcome. House Bill 2288 in Section 3 outlines a few priority areas of focus for the Council as it works to achieve that goal. And those include encouraging the adoption and expansion of local food purchase policies and practices, strengthening existing efforts to foster and develop small farming operations and local agriculture marketing opportunities, expanding education and outreach programs that help communities and schools understand food production, food preparation, and how to maximize the consumption of nutritious foods, and provide technical support for communities who may have an interest in creating their own local food policy councils. In closing, I just want to emphasize that the governor's view that House Bill 2288 represents an opportunity to create a platform, really, at the state level that would bring together conversations that in some cases are already happening, but are happening in different silos, whether those are state agency silos, anti-hunger advocate silos, or food and farming organization silos. We feel that by leveraging the expertise that exists in each of those silos, and really by enhancing our collective understanding of each other's perspectives, House Bill 2288 will lead to a more coordinated, more efficient, and more comprehensive focus on strengthening Oregon's food system and improving Oregonians' food security. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we want to wait and have all three go before we have questions. Okay. Next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Rick Krager. I'm the chief finance, or excuse me, I am the deputy director of Oregon Housing Community Services. I apologize. Recently the chief financial officer, so I haven't got used to that title yet. The Department and Department of Agriculture have worked in partnership to develop House Bill 2288, which creates the Oregon Food Policy Council. The Food Policy Council will facilitate collaboration between key partners and stakeholders in identifying ways to improve access to Oregon-produced food items for all Oregonians and enhance the vitality of the agriculture and food processing industry. Oregon Housing Community Services currently serves as a lead agency to coordinate state efforts in meeting the problems of hunger. Between 1999 and 2001, the rate of hunger in Oregon was 5.2%, which was the highest in the nation. Since that time, the hunger rate has improved to 3.8% and is now 24th in the nation. During this same period, the food insecurity rate in the state has dropped from 13.4% to 11.8%. While the rates for hunger and food insecurity are still slightly above the national average, the state has made tremendous strides in the last 5 years. Part of the success in each of these areas can be contributed to the Department's Interagency Coordinating Council on Hunger and the Hunger Relief Task Force. And, Mr. Chairman, I know that Patty Whitney Wise will be testifying after us, a member of the Hunger Relief Task Force, and she'll be providing you some examples of some of the successes that we've seen in the system over the last 5 years. Through the Interagency Coordinating Council on Hunger, the Department works to coordinate state agency hunger relief efforts, ensure that food and nutrition programs operate efficiently and effectively, monitor the utilization of federal hunger relief efforts, provide outreach to expand underutilized programs, and encourage the coordination of state and local food programs. In dealing with the problems of hunger and food insecurity, it is important to not only identify ways to increase the availability of food, but also ensure that the food provided is nutritious for the consumer. A healthy diet can reduce the incidence of health conditions such as diabetes and cardiovascular disease. According to the most recent Oregon statistics, these two diet-related health conditions account for 39% of all deaths in Oregon. Through House Bill 2288, the Oregon Food Policy Council will be established to review state and local food systems and recommend improvements related to the linkages between food producers, consumers, and policymakers. The council will consist of 22 members who represent a wide range of interests in each of these areas. It is the department's intent that the Food Policy Council will work closely with the Interagency Coordinating Council as it relates to increasing the access and availability of nutritious food produced here in the state of Oregon for individuals who are suffering from hunger or food insecurity. And I think Aaron touched on a few of these, but the goals of the Oregon Food Policy Council will include improving access to nutritious, fresh, and processed foods, reducing the number of Oregonians suffer from hunger or food insecurity, increasing the purchase of locally grown or processed foods in various regions of the state, expanding the number of food-related businesses and jobs, and enhancing agriculture and food processing vitality. House Bill 2288 does have a fiscal impact included in the governor's recommended budget for Oregon Housing Community Service. This fiscal establishes positions to staff and support the Food Policy Council and coordinate the interrelationships with the Interagency Coordinating Council on Hunger, the Hunger Relief Task Force, and the Ending Homelessness Advisory Council. In summary, Mr. Chair, House Bill 2288 creates opportunities for not only individuals and families suffering from hunger and food insecurity, but it also creates economic opportunities for food-producing and agriculture communities. This bill will bring together important organizational leaders to discuss these discuss issues related to hunger, nutrition, and agriculture procurement. Their discussion and research will benefit the state agencies that are charged with making policies and implementing food programs throughout the state. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my overview of the bill, and we urge your support of House Bill 2288. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dalton Hoff. I'm the Assistant Director for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And rather than duplicate the already good remarks of my colleagues here, just allow me to say that the Oregon Department of Agriculture is in support of this. We work jointly with our colleagues to develop this, and we believe that it provides a very important point at which these interests can be convened and discuss these issues in a whole manner. And we would also urge your support of this bill as well. Thank you.
Any questions of this panel?
Yes.
Thank you, Chair Robin. I have a question for Mr. Krager. You mentioned a fiscal impact to the Oregon Housing Community. Could you give me an idea of what that is, the amount?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, currently in the Oregon Housing Community Services budget, or in the governor's recommended budget, is a $345,000 fiscal impact that creates positions for the department in the general fund.
Yes, ma'am.
Could you give me an idea of how many positions we're talking?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, 2.5 FTE.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, Representative
Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a couple questions, and I looked at the list. I think you're going to be the best folks to answer them. I'm looking at the membership on the committee, and sometimes these are describing things that you probably have in mind, but maybe I just can't figure it out. So the Oregon Food Bank or the Food Bank Network, is that somewhere in here in one of these folks that would be appointed?
Chair Roblin, Representative Clem, under Section 1J, capital J, there's two series of letters here, so forgive me as I get oriented.
Gotcha.
I think that those folks could be considered for the position identified as one person representing an anti-hunger organization.
Another one, Mr. Chair. And I guess I just want to state for the record, I mean, I think this is great. You know, the way that we grow pears, a lot of times what will happen is we'll come down and do a fruit stand. I don't sell them all. We go to the food bank, donate the rest of them. I mean, having someone think about how to systematize that all the way across agriculture and make it easier, because it's a little rough sometimes. My Ford Explorer's getting old. I'm hauling them around. Luckily, they got forklifts. So I love what you're doing here for all of farming. I do have a question about C, which is sustainable agricultural interests. What exactly are we talking about here?
Chair Roblin, Representative Clem, I think one of the goals when we were putting together the membership list, it actually was one of the most challenging pieces of the work in organizing our thoughts around this concept. And I think the challenge is to be as inclusive as possible, but also create a number that is somewhat manageable in terms of having a quality discussion. When it comes to a representative representing sustainable agriculture interests, I think the idea there was to make sure that folks in the agriculture community who do undertake a sustainable farming production effort, people who participate in co-ops, things of that nature, would be able to have a voice at the table as these discussions were going on.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Yep.
So co-ops is in not necessarily we're talking about the practices on the orchard. Like, for example, Food Alliance, voluntary sort of program, they come and talk to you about your labor practices, integrated pest management, you know, other kinds of activities that most farmers want to do. It's a new marketable activity to engage in, so even if they didn't want to, now it's a pretty good idea because it sells better. Is that what we're talking about? Are we talking about, you know, pure sort of organic? Or are we, you know, we're talking about, or is that not known and that's why it's worded the way it is, so you can pick and choose?
Chair and Representative Klein, I think it was intended to be broad in terms of its application and definition, but perhaps if Dalton has any other explanation, he can support me because his knowledge of this area is much greater than mine.
I think that the kind of, as you've described, the Food Alliance sort of approach where you're looking at various aspects that get you at sustainable practices, but not narrowly prescriptive. That is, it's not solely the province of organic production or any one particular production practice, but rather more of a general approach to sustainable practices. And I think that you'll see in the department's budget later on, or maybe the Ways and Means certainly will, where we have actual positions and a whole newest initiative based on a Center for Sustainable Agricultural Practices that is a joint activity between the College of Agricultural Science and the Department of Agriculture. So there is this emerging and growing interest in sustainable agriculture here in Oregon, but it is not narrowly defined. It is more general in nature.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair.
One more question.
I guess because I don't see in what they would be talking about or strategies, you know, I see some things here that I think are all really great. I just want to make sure that if one of the topics of conversation are, you know, labor practices, use of spray, that there's enough representation on all sides to have the conversation, or that that's not really what this whole group is for, and that's really off the table for talking about this, because this is about hunger and food, not about those other things. And I just want to make sure that's kind of in here, because there are multiple sides to every story.
Chair Roblin, Representative Klem, I really appreciate that point. I think, again, the bill was intending to give some broad categories as suggestions for possible discussion, but we have had some feedback of folks who have an interest in maybe creating some parameters around certain issues, and that I don't think that should be a barrier to us considering this as a concept, and it's certainly not something that for us is a challenge. I do think, though, that there really was an attempt made. If you look at the division, I know 22 sounds like a large number, but there are 6 agency representatives, and the purpose there was to ensure that, you know, as to the state agencies that ultimately probably have some involvement in this area already, there was broad representation. And then the individual appointees number in 16, about 8 of those really fall into the category of people with significant experience in farming and agriculture, and the other 8 are really drawn from that whole vision of kind of bringing the anti-hunger community together with the farming and agriculture community. And so we have had some discussion about making sure that this group is dealing with topics upon which they are qualified to make recommendations around, and we're open to suggestions about how to tailor that if people think there are certain things that we should do differently about goals or topics for discussion for the council.
Just one last one, Mr. Chair, I promise.
You can ask anybody else any other questions.
Oh, I know there's more. I just you've made me very comfortable. I just want to. I mean, I know this is a recommender. It's not going to be making policy. It'll be recommending policy. I just want to make sure that all the things that are so important in here. About increasing the purchasing of local foods and enhancing the vitality of the industry, and feeding hungry people, that's all we talk about, and let the rest of us go battle out the other stuff.
I will.
And I do have 2 bills on this topic too, Mr. Chair. I'll be bringing school to farm and some other stuff.
Representative Maurer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple questions, specifically, I mean, I laud this effort, and I appreciate all the hard work that's gone into it. One thing, when we bring in a new program, and I saw this with the commodity commissions, that there was a sunset associated. So if it doesn't work, if it blows up, that we don't have, you know, 2 FTE that are just sitting out there in perpetuity. And so I would ask, you know, to consider a sunset, whether it's 2 years, 4 years, whatever reasonable period of time. Because if it works, great. If it doesn't, then, you know, let's try something else that might. So that's just a comment. Yeah. And if you had considered a sunset, I'd appreciate to know that also.
Representative Trouble, Representative Maurer. Yes, I think that, you know, this governor is very supportive of sunsets for exactly the reason you've described, that we don't want to presume that everything we put together is going to work forever. So we should revisit it and make sure it's working.
Okay, thank you.
And I'll just make one comment for this group. And from my perspective, when I read the bill, and I come from the education background, and there is currently, in my opinion, a very big disconnect between urban and rural people with respect to agriculture. Right. And there is a need out there to have people coming and seeing what we actually do on farms and in the rural areas. And if this can help that happen, and I was at a national ag conference last week, and there are states that are starting to do this, but if we can get kids and schools out to see what's happening in farms and understand that, you know, we have the safest and the actually the least expensive as a portion of our income, food products in the world, that if we can start opening that dialogue so that kids know that milk doesn't come from a carton, it comes from other places, that they understand that the carrots in the can didn't magically appear in the store. And I think we've lost some of that in our society over the last number of years. And so anytime we can get people out there and see what's really happening and how hard the people work to produce that food, I think is a good thing. So when I looked at it, I thought, there's some hope here. And I've seen some things in our local schools where we're starting to do that again that make me heartened that people will really understand again and that people will produce local food and be able to feed people. And that's all our farmers really want to do. And they'd like to make a little profit, so they have something they can plant the next year. But I look at this as a good starting place. I think we're going to have enough testimony that we will look at some kind of work group so we can get some other things worked out, in my opinion. But from the beginning, I like the idea, and we'll hear from other people and see how they go with that. So thank you.
Thank you.
And our next person is Patty Whitney Wise. Is that Sharon?
Yes, Sharon.
Okay, good. Sharon, you can come on up too. And is that
Danelda?
Okay, that's good. We'll have another panel. That's great.
Thank you very much, Chair Roblin and committee. My name is Patty Whitney Wise, and I'm the executive director at the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force. I spoke with most of you who I could get into ahead of time, so you had a little bit of background on this proposal. And given the excellent testimony, you'll get mine in writing. I'd like to just respond to a couple of things. One is that over the years, we have had experience both with the task force and diverse membership in the task force and with the Interagency Coordinating Council on Hunger. And we have had those moments where people have been in disagreement. They've had different perspectives, and we've worked through it. The fact that we're all at the table together has made a huge difference. And we've had a lot of success. One of the biggest successes has to do with our food stamp program. We've almost doubled participation since the year 2000, and that took the work of all of us together and many more Oregonians. And the researchers who have looked at it have attributed that as the single most important or biggest reason why our hunger rate has gone down. You have distributed along with our testimony a copy of our executive summary to the Act to End Hunger. It was our second executive summary. It summed up our work in the first 2 years, our accomplishments, and our next steps. So you have before you a document that gives you the history of how we've done. And in the first 2 years of the Act to End Hunger, we made progress on 20 out of the 40 items in the Act to End Hunger. So I think that also speaks to the collaboration that has happened. And that's by way of saying we see this statewide food policy council as providing a forum for similar kind of collaboration between rural, urban, between farmers and consumers. Farm to school is a big piece of it. I think there are some barriers we're beginning to identify where schools are having difficulty procuring locally, things that a statewide group could help take care of that local groups really can't. And that's part of the reason for the statewide focus, is to help work with those local groups already formed to find out where their barriers are and where there are ways that we at the state level can make recommendations that will help smooth the way for them. So I'm available for any questions you might have. The others before me have presented it very eloquently, and I have two more very eloquent people here to present as well. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, committee members. I'm Sharon Thornberry. I'm the Community Food Programs Advocate for Oregon Food Bank, and I'm here to testify on behalf of our organization in support of House Bill 2288, which would create the Oregon Food Policy Council. We feel the creation of a statewide food policy council would be a tool for discussion and possible resolution of many issues that would have a positive effect on low-income Oregonians. Some of the issues include farm to school. Experience has taught us that school and summer food programs are an excellent means of getting food to low-income children. Implementing a statewide farm to school initiative would greatly improve the quality of those meals and increase markets for Oregon's farmers and build students' appreciation for fresh regional products. And we have an excellent example of that already going on in Central Oregon in the Ben Lapine School District. Katrina Wiest is their wellness specialist, and she's doing an outstanding job getting that started, and she's purchasing regionally for, and she has fresh product into January and February for students there. So we have great examples. We have great possibilities. And she's already seen farmers purchasing more land and leasing more land so that they can satisfy her. Just one school district. It has huge potential for us. Another area that we feel that could be addressed is declining food industry. Oregon Food Bank and its network have certainly felt the effects of a decline in food processing in our state and the consequent impacts on agriculture, both in a reduction of quantity and varieties of the donations we receive. The proposed Food Policy Council could address the ongoing decline in Oregon food processing and play a role in bringing back its traditional base of local food and employment. We also have seen the impacts of a loss of retail access. The presence of full-service retail markets in rural areas of Oregon have declined greatly, leaving many low-income Oregonians, and not just low-income Oregonians, but often elderly or disabled Oregonians, with transportation challenges in acquiring food. Some of them have no choice but to turn to an emergency food pantry because it's literally the only place in their community to get food. The only other choices they have are self-service markets, which often really have just fast food that addresses tourists in that area, and so they really can't get food. I think that that would be a valuable piece of the discussion of this Food Policy Council, and also low-income Oregonians aren't able to efficiently utilize food stamps if they can get access to them if the only place they have to go is a small grocery, a self-service type grocery. It's not a good use of their food stamps. Another area is nutrition. Diet-related diseases are on the rise, and low-income Oregonians are all that much more likely to be victims of these diseases. And any efforts to improve nutritional quality of our state's food system will have a positive impact on those Oregonians. Lastly, collaboration and community building. One of my jobs with the food bank is working with a growing number of food policy councils and community food systems coalitions and organizations working on the food system in the state. And there are several across the state, not just in the western Oregon, but across the state, eastern Oregon also. Citizens in many of those communities, counties, and regions of our state have organized, and the missions of their organizations to improve the quality of Oregon's food system and to support local and regional agriculture. They're rethinking how we acquire food, reaching out to educate communities about where their food comes from. The local initiatives also are actively engaging in documenting their current food systems through assessment processes and looking for avenues of change. A statewide food policy council would enhance these local activities by acting as a network for sharing of ideas and best practices, and also by coordinating regional activities between these local councils. It would also provide an avenue for when these local organizations find that there are state policy implications that could be helpful to them, so it would give them an avenue to bring those ideas forward. I think that a food policy council could bring together public and private partners to discuss, collaborate, resolve issues, influence policy that will change and revitalize Oregon's food system. The efforts would improve the health and quality of our food for consumers and create a brighter future for Oregon agriculture and its food industry. And for a second, I'd like to take off my Oregon Food Bank hat and talk about another role that I play. For the past 3 years, I've served as the president of the Community Food Security Coalition, which is a North American organization that provides one of the things that they do. We work on farm to school very actively, and another thing that we've done for the last year is provide technical assistance to food policy councils through a USDA Risk Management Agency grant. And so we work with these organizations And there are now dozens across the United States that are both local and statewide food policy councils. And this morning I talked with Mark Whitty, who was one of the original architects of this concept in Connecticut. And he said to me, and I was talking to him about some of the concerns that have been raised by organizations, and he said that what they found is that food policy councils work best when they talk about the things they can agree on and that they can find common ground on. They haven't been talking to each other on, but they can find common ground on. Leave those really big, controversial things alone. And sometimes you get to the place, and what I've seen in working with the other commissions here in Oregon or coalitions here in Oregon is then sometimes you get to the place where you trust each other enough that you can work on the big stuff too. I think there are real advantages, and there are a lot of examples across the country of people doing this, and I think it's really time that we in Oregon do it also. So thank you very much, and I'll be happy to answer questions.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, I'm Danelda Dodson. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Child Development Coalition, and I'm a member of the Hunger Task Force. On the Hunger Task Force, I represent migrant, so we're very connected to the agricultural community of our state. I do not want to repeat a lot of things that other individuals have said, but just to stress what has been mentioned about there are a lot of local efforts that are being done to bring food security systems to their local communities, and what is needed now is a state focus, to bring that state focus for the regional food systems. By bringing that together, we can do the connectedness that needs to be done to form the policies that need to be made to help bring these farming and urban issues out and to be discussed and to be acted upon. By focusing on the food system itself, we can bring together the food-related public and private entities that have an impact on our economic development in agriculture. And as an agricultural state, that's very important to us. By harnessing all of this human power together and identifying policies that are needed in the food system, we can aid our community's economic development, we can provide food for our children and families, and we can link our agricultural production, our public's health, and our community's well-being. As a native Oregonian and as a public health advocate, and most recently as an early childhood advocate, I see that these concerns are important for our future as well as our current day. By looking at these opportunities, this helps us to craft a collective stewardship for our children's future and for the future of our state. It helps give us a tool that will help assure a healthful, livable, and sustainable future for Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee? Representative Clown.
Mr. Chair, this is partially for your benefit. You probably knew this, but I just wanted to, A, commend the task force for its support of the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program budget last time. And also, were you aware that there is another proposal this time called the Shared Responsibility Model that has some funding options, but it would again place a significant increase in need-based aid and be able to extend up a little bit below our kind of cliff where you fall off because you're over a dollar.
We're definitely aware of it, and when we're asked, we'll support it.
That's all I have. Okay. That's my agenda right there. Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, again, thank you for this panel. And while they're leaving, Katie Fass, and did Mark Nelson want to come up with Katie? Is that what the little line said? Katie, is that okay with you?
That is okay. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, Katie Fass with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Our organization promotes direct farm-to-consumer marketing options, and many of our members are benefiting from Oregonians' increased interest in buying local. We also want to help Oregonians have affordable and local food choices and are troubled by the hunger struggles that we see even in our own rural communities. We support programs that accomplish these goals, and we support efforts to bridge the urban-rural divide that unfortunately exists. However, there are several items within House Bill 2288 that bring us some concern. First, as you're aware, Oregon agriculture is extremely diverse, and in the development of the legislation, many of Oregon's major agricultural organizations were not consulted with, including the Oregon Farm Bureau. If this dialogue would have occurred during the session, hopefully our issues of apprehension would have been resolved. Our first meeting with housing and other proponents of the bill occurred yesterday. Oregon agriculture is a highly regulated industry, as you're aware, and we're facing new challenges annually through increased regulations, increased production costs, and sometimes unforgiving markets. This framework makes us skeptical of a new government program through which adoptions of policies and recommendations are going to occur. A primary concern of our organization is that policies would be adopted that would promote products based on production practices used, and farm operations not in line with these policies would be prohibited from participating in the program. Our research on food policy councils throughout the nation bring up some of this concern. Recommendations incur regarding animal husbandry practices, promotion of organics, recommendations on genetically modified crops, and other production issues occur. These practices in Oregon are heavily regulated and done so quite well by the Oregon Department of Agriculture and other agencies that have the expertise and resources to make policy decisions. We also have concern within the budget that there is $350,000 going to housing, but not an adequate budget amount for a Department of Agriculture to participate on the council. Their expertise is needed greatly in this area. Farm Bureau recognizes that the proponents have great intentions, and we agree with many of those intentions. But agriculture needs to be at the table. We ask that this bill go to a work group, that some of these issues can be resolved. And I'd also like to say we also are supportive of the sunset concept that Representative Maurer suggested. This gives time for the policy council to get developed and then also time to review to see if it's doing what the legislative intent is. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thanks. Well, Mark, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson. I represent the Northwest Food Processors Association. I want to thank you for the opportunity to provide comments today. The Northwest Food Processing Association represents the food processing industry in Oregon. 17,000 people are employed, payroll of around $500 million. But as you know, we've experienced some serious challenges in the last few years in the industry. Legislation passed last session with the help of Governor Kulongowski. Senate Bill 479 has greatly helped the industry, and we very much appreciate that support. We, like the Farm Bureau, do support some of the concepts in 2288, notably enhancing the ag industry and expanding food-related businesses and jobs. However, we have some of the same concerns that Katie has related to you. The history of food policy councils in some other states, and some of the things that they have promoted, as has been indicated, food labeling and animal husbandry and others. We also feel that there should be an emphasis on including all farms and food processors, not just small farm operations, obviously. While institutions such as farmers markets and small farms are beneficial to community efforts, we need to remember that about 80% of the crops and livestock grown and processed in Oregon are shipped or exported for sale out of the state of Oregon. The food processing industry provides a significant support to communities, especially in rural areas, through jobs and revenue. So we think the farms and food processors really do need to be a part of this process. We appreciate the governor's current efforts to provide economic development support to this industry and encourages support through and encourages long-term support through the council. Regarding some of the language in the bill, there is a reference to, quote, improving access to fresh and nutritious foods, unquote. Food Processors Association supports, obviously, access to nutritious foods, but does not agree that nutritious foods necessarily equates to fresh. and which are typically defined as not processed. In fact, evidence supports that some of the frozen fruits and vegetables we process them within hours after harvest, and as such, their nutritional value is often higher than quote fresh food that which may be several days old. We support the education outreach that teaches Oregonians about food production and developing the urban-rural partnership, and I think that's very, very important. Lack of this understanding, as we all know, has led to misconceptions throughout the last 10 years and has further, I think, added to the divide. So I think overcoming those misconceptions is obviously very important. We appreciate the good intentions from the advocates and proponents of this bill. We, too, just learned about it yesterday, so we would like to continue the conversation in a work group with proponents of this legislation to see if we can work through possible changes in the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nelson, I'm new to the Agriculture Committee, and there may be there are code words that I'm not sensitive to, but when I look at the bill and the charge to the council about what it's to deal with, I don't see the how it engages issues like designation of organics or genetically restrictions on genetically modified foods, or there may be something that I'm not reading here, or maybe it's because of, I think you alluded to, the experience in other states that maybe is driving the concern. So maybe it's not something that's within the four corners of the bill, and I just wanted to find out what it is we could that would be modified in the bill, what amendment to it would resolve the concerns you have.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, I am fairly new to the Northwest Food Processors, in fact, about 3 weeks. So I join you.
We'll learn together.
Our lack of understanding. But it's been reported in that these councils in other states have been used to develop and forward policies that are adverse from the agricultural and food processing point of view, adverse to those interests. And this, as you see in Section 3, many of these things are fairly broad. The references to fresh, nutritious foods does bring us some concern. There are those who believe that all processed foods are bad. So you are getting a certain amount of our paranoia, and we call it healthy paranoia. So we would just like to work through this, have that opportunity to do so.
Follow up if I could. Would you be looking for changes in the makeup of the council, changes in the charge to the council, or both, in a bill that would be satisfactory? And if you haven't thought that far along, feel free to say.
I defer to someone who's been around longer than
that.
Chair Roblin, Representative McPherson, I think that the makeup is more on the charge of the council and narrowing that broadness down so that they are really focusing on hunger issues, food delivery systems, school nutrition, and not focusing on what happens at the farm. And right now we're concerned about that there aren't those clarifications in the bill. I would say, though, since there was a discussion before, we are maybe not – we're questioning the sustainable agriculture and what that means in the makeup of the bill. That definition could be defined multiple ways by multiple people. And from my organization's perspective, probably the majority of our members are sustainable agriculture because they have sustained in many cases for centuries. And without the social, environmental, and economic structures of their operations, they would not have been able to do so. So they, in our feeling, meet the definition of sustainable, but there's a lot of questions, and I think you got a few different answers when that question was asked.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, much better answer than mine.
Yes, Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We heard some discussion about potentially, you know, a sunset on the council just to check back and make sure it's working out. Are you envisioning a sunset on this work group you're proposing so we can make sure we get this bill done this session as long as...
We would follow at the direction of the chair and the timeline that is given.
Thank you. I vote for the sense out on the worker, Mr. Chair.
I want to get this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a quick question, and I'm not sure, Kate, if you're the right person or Department of Agriculture, but I thought I recall hearing from the first panel that there was discussions among the agricultural community, so I'm just curious who that was, or was it strictly the Department of Ag, or if the Department of Ag consulted with some of the members, and it probably might be good to have the Department of Agriculture come back up, that's what I recall hearing.
Well,
but
I will wait and let them answer.
It's a good clarification, because I heard them say that the Department of Ag was there. I didn't hear them say that there were other groups. Oh, okay.
So I can see a little bit of passing the buck here. But if the Department of Agriculture was involved, then I would think it's part of the job of the Department of Agriculture to communicate with the folks that you work with, to get input.
Chair Roblin, Representative Dingfelder, again, Erin Kelly Seal for the record, and I appreciate the question. In a similar fashion, I think, to the recent communication by Representative McPherson, I think what became clear to us when we sat down with folks at the table yesterday is that, you know, we had made some assumptions about communications and clarity that maybe hadn't taken place. We were using the Department of Ag through the Governor's Office as a conduit. They are one of our arms, if you will, and we do rely on them heavily to communicate with their constituents. But we did have one small farmer and then one person who's on the Board of Agriculture who was representing herself, not the board, in our group discussions when we were putting the concept together. And then, as I said, I also did go present to the Board of Agriculture personally last fall. So I think while it is very much the case that we did not sit down at the table personally with the Farm Bureau before yesterday, I think we had maybe just mistakenly assumed that they were giving feedback through the department, but we are more than willing to continue and sit down at the table again at the direction of the chair, and wouldn't mind having a quick sunset in terms of that discussion, because I think, I hope that many of the issues that have arisen are pretty resolvable in terms of the bill.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, during the roll-up of this bill, our staff, our policy development people, did communicate through email with the farm community. Unfortunately, in the dissonance of all of the things that go out, probably we could have done a better job with that. And for that, Katie, we apologize. However, we think that the current path of perhaps sorting this thing out here in the next few weeks can probably resolve some of those concerns about prior notification and an opportunity really to participate. There certainly was no intent to obfuscate or cloud this issue.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you all. Marcus Salmon?
Mantle,
thank you.
My name is Marcus Samantle. I am the small farmer that was just
should have worn it on your.
And I have to say, I did not think of myself as a small farmer. We had from 10 to 20 employees and involved in an awful lot of agricultural activities. Anyhow, my name is Marcus Samantle, and I just finished serving 4 years on the Portland Multnomah County Food Policy Council, part of that time as co-chair. And I would say that initially I was the token farmer on that food council there in Portland. And I also, as you just found out, I participated in the group that outlined a lot of what you find in 2288. A couple points I'd make, because I think most of the pros and cons have already been put on the table. I believe that the Portland Multnomah Food Policy Council has been quite beneficial for Portland city government and for Multnomah County government, primarily because we have successfully brought food system issues to their attention, such as land use, planning, food access, institutional purchasing, school food issues, etc. Most Americans have taken food for granted now for several decades, but we need to be paying attention. Food is basic, and today with higher and higher energy costs, with global warming, climate change, and the expectation of another million people here in Oregon in the next 30, 40 years, I think we better be paying attention to our food system. And food policy councils help all of us keep our eye on the ball. And when you look at the 22 people that are suggested to be parts of this, you see such a wide range of folks involved. And if I have a criticism of Portland government, it's that it has silos. Mm-hmm. And I think state government does too, and so a state food policy council, I think, can help with that. Also, the industry does. A second point, when my wife and I moved from the farm to Portland in 1998, I was really surprised to find so many people interested in food there in Portland. After a while, I learned to call them foodies. I had never heard that term. I don't know if you have, but foodies. And two things really stood out to me. First, they really were sincere in their interest in food and where it comes from and how it was produced and who produced it and were those farmers successful and would they be viable. And I heard over and over again, we want to support local agriculture. And secondly, they had a fairly limited view of what agriculture really was all about. And I think that through the Food Policy Council in Portland, that they have expanded their understanding of what agriculture is here in Oregon. I don't know how many times I've stood up and said things like, we grow over 225 commodities here in Oregon. Most of the food, most of the production is exported, so we can't just think local, but localization or relocalization versus globalization has its place here also. I know that Food Policy Council in Portland expanded the understanding of these foodies, as well as the city and county officials, which I think is very, very important. And I think the state could do that. Along those same lines, food policy councils help farmers understand, including me, that city folks care about their viability. City folks are not farmers' adversaries. They are their customers. And I see that one of the benefits of 2288 is to add another opportunity for that bridge between the urban and rural divide. And I thank you. I support it. I could respond to some of the things that were said earlier. That's enough. Thank you very much.
Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi, Marcus. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. You know, having been on a county food was it Multnomah County?
It was jointly created by City Council and by Multnomah County Commission.
I just wondered whether it would be more helpful or less helpful from your experience, depending who was on there, to throw in, for example, a member of the legislature. We sometimes do that on commissions. It's not here. I don't know if it's a good idea or not, to be honest. I just wonder if you have a thought on that.
No, I think that would be fine. That would make 23.
Yeah.
I would say that the county commissioner that sort of headed up that part of their activities attended quite a few of our meetings and almost always had a staff person there.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have one last person, and that's Jim Welch, Oregon Catalans.
Chair Roblin, committee members. I'm Jim Welch, representing Oregon State. I was going to say Oregon State Grange, definitely them too, but I'm speaking today for Oregon Cattlemen Association. We have just been looking at this and haven't established any definite policy. We have our board members arriving on the 6th, spending a couple days here for their board meeting. But just a couple of comments here on this bill. And we believe if the Food Policy Council is a good idea, then the agriculture producers should be a big part of the development. And we haven't been. Okay. Definitely interesting and possibly laudable objectives in Section 3. But we need to connect certainly the intentions of this bill, the sponsors of the bill, and the agriculture industry. Oregon Department of Agriculture's budget is stretched, and we think involvement at this level, I think, in fact, there's involvement for that agency beyond what this bill identifies, and they need to connect the dollars and make them follow and help them. And certainly if it stays under the Housing Community Development, then there's a consideration for them too. But I think we would rather see the lead agency here be the Department of Agriculture, because we're talking about a lot of agriculture issues here. Okay. We ask that this bill go to a work group where all concerned can help with further recommendations. And I take the liberty here certainly to mention the need for more general fund dollars for agriculture. And we agree with Rep. Maurer. Please include a sunset clause. I think that'd be very helpful here. But we're more than happy to be involved, and I think we should be. And we look forward to working with you.
Okay. Thank you
very much. We take your lead.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you. We will set up a work group, and what I will ask is that you get a hold of Beth Petrino, who is our staff, and we'll get a group of people in the next 2 weeks. I agree. I think we need to have it sunsetted, too. If we can't get something together in a couple of weeks, then I think we'll go from there. But I would appreciate it. I really like it. Is there anybody else here who is here because they would like to testify but didn't sign up? Okay. Then I will. And if there's anybody here on the committee that would like to be on that work group, what?
I think Brian Plummer.
Okay. Brian, you're going to be on the committee? On that work group?
Yes, Mr. Principal. I mean, Mr. Chair.
And we will close our hearing on 2288. And hopefully this is fairly quick. We were going to open a hearing on 2291. And while we're doing that, Lisa Hansen from ODA and Jeff Stone, OAN, can come up, and Beth will give us a short explanation of the bill.
House Bill 2291 reduces the minimum license fee for nursery growers and dealers from $65 to $30. It also establishes a minimum assessment to fund nursery research and affects other assessments on nursery growers. And I think given the time, I'll maybe let the department do the explanation.
That's right. I agree. Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture. Thank you for the opportunity to visit with you about House Bill 2291. This was an attempt by the agency to do some streamlining for the nursery industry and take into consideration some of these small, low-volume wholesalers that were paying a relatively high fee as a percentage of their gross sales. And spread that out a little bit. But with all things, with good intentions, there are some challenges with that, and we have identified potentially some need for amendments in the bill. We had looked at decoupling basically this from our traditional fiscal year licensing period to a calendar year. However, that is not such a good idea after additional look and work on this issue. So with that, if you'd like more detail about the reasoning, I would like Dan Hilburn to provide that, if that would suit your wishes, or if I provided adequate explanation, that would be fine too.
It appears that we're probably going to get this back a little bit with some amendments, so we can do more of that later in the explanation. So I think we're okay.
Okay.
Unless anybody here is dying. Yes.
I do have a question.
Okay, that's great.
And I'm not sure if this is related, but we heard a bill. It's just for anybody who wants to answer this, including Mr. Stone. He asked. We joked about not asking tough questions, but I have one. Okay, we heard about increased involvement by the Department of Agriculture, and I don't remember the House bill number. We just heard the sudden oat death, working with nurseries to set up audit programs. If I recall, I think that was the intent. So then I was like, okay, so we're asking for more money for that, yet we're going to decrease these fees. And so if you could, I mean, I'll be on Ways and Means, too, asking the same question, so you could wait and answer it there. But that's something that just came to my mind, given that we're looking at a program on one end and then reducing fees on this. So maybe you can help me connect the dots.
Dan, I think it's probably the good one for you.
I don't mind answering.
You guys can both take a crack. Yes.
Dan Hilburn with the Department of Agriculture, Chair Roblin, Representative Dinkfelder. This bill addresses one problem, and that is a different issue. This one, we have an issue with small, it's retailers, not wholesalers, retailers, people like garden clubs and flower shops and farmers markets that want to sell plants. But the current law says if you sell $250 worth of plants, you have to have a nursery license. And the current license is $120. Mm. So it's you make $250 and you send half to the government. And it's very hard to enforce, and it's not right. So we would like to address that problem. What we hope will happen is we'll lose some money doing that, but we'll also gain a lot more people on the low end who are not paying now.
Right.
So it's not as bad as it looks for the department revenue-wise.
Okay. So just a quick follow-up.
Yes,
so you're looking at a sliding scale based on nursery sales or... I mean, do you have a flat fee now? Is that it?
No. Chair Roblin, Representative Dinkfelder, the sliding scales are all in rule.
Okay.
And it goes all the way up to folks that make in the millions and pay $20,000 for a nursery license. So it's not a flat fee at all. This would be flat for the very lowest folks. And it would also be exempt from the research assessment and the emergency fund assessment.
Any other questions? No. Mr. Stone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jeff Stone, I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. Just to remind you, we are your largest sector in agriculture. Also ranked third in the country for nursery crops, so that's always important to mention. The Oregon Association of Nurseries supports House Bill 2291 as amended, as you will see, but we support the ODA's amendments, and we recommend the committee's approval. The Nursery and Greenhouse License Program is a product of the industry and government cooperation. The nursery and greenhouse industry volunteered for a system of licensing and fees in order to provide comprehensive inspection and regulation. In addition to protecting the health of the nursery and greenhouse industry, the program prevents introduction of unwanted and harmful plant pests and disease, and protects Oregon's native plant resources. We see House Bill 2291 as a strengthening of an already effective system of inspection and regulation. House Bill 2291 intends to bring more people under the umbrella of ODA's Nursery and Greenhouse License Program by lowering license fees for the smallest commercial operators. The movement of plant material in Oregon that may introduce pests and diseases is a significant threat. And it's important that small growers and handlers of nursery and greenhouse plant material be licensed. Licensing is an important tool for ODA to track handlers of plant material, to communicate regulatory requirements and changes, and to conduct inspections as circumstances warrant. The nursery license fee has not been adjusted since 2003. And while this bill will carry a small fiscal impact, in our opinion, we believe the failure to include more small operators leaves open the possible entry of unwanted plant material to the state. This is why the OAN supports this bill and the ODA's effort to bring more operators into the program by lowering the license fee. It is our view that the proposal outlined in HB 2291 will increase the number of licensed nurseries. This is good for the nursery industry and good for Oregon. I appreciate your time and attention today and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
Chair, just
yes. One question. I'm sorry, I just got to get this out. Jeff, the other night, I know you're the number one industry in agriculture. The other night, I think it was Clackamas County, claimed they wanted to get into the number one position for total agricultural products. Could you enlighten us who number one is now currently?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, that would be the county in which you represent.
Thank you very much for stuff. Thank you very much. That's all I got.
I did have another question,
that's
though.
Okay, that's good. That's a real question?
A real question. So the fiscal is, I'm assuming, the rulemaking, because you're adding rulemaking to the Department of Agriculture's budget that wasn't there before. What's this? You said there was a slight...
A loss of income.
Okay, so there's not an increase in the department's budget necessarily, because you already have the rulemaking authority. Is that correct?
Okay. Chair Roland, Representative Dingfelder, that's correct. We already have the rulemaking authority. It's the potential loss of income. But with that, we think by lowering the fee, we will get more people to license, which actually, in terms of trying to bring them in under the umbrella and the compliance aspects of it, makes compliance easier for the agency longer term.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Dingfelder, if I might add, the Nursery Association is working with the six western states of nursery and growers to come up with a pest, plant, and disease system nationally. And we firmly believe that having more people licensed, that traffic that can bring in plant material through mail order or unknowingly grow things that could have significant issues, we want to try to help educate those folks just as much as trying to prevent diseases from getting into other states.
Okay. Any other questions? Seeing that there are still a few people back there, is there anyone else in the audience that would like to speak to the bill? I see none. Then we will close our hearing on 2291. Look forward to having you back when you have some amendments. Any questions or anything for the group? Then we will close our meeting on Ag and Natural Resources.
Thank you.
And have a wonderful day.